I'd like to welcome now to the program Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Alan Taylor. He is a professor of American history at the University of California, Davis, and he will be giving a lecture tonight titled The First American Civil War, The Revolution. It's at the New Mexico History Museum Auditorium at 6:30 tonight, sponsored by the School for Advanced Research. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
So let's start talking about this subject with a quotation from your book, The Civil War of 1812, American Citizens, British Subjects, Irish Rebels, and Indian Allies. There is a quotation that you use right at the beginning from a piece called An American Farmer, and it says the following: as much as the people of the two nations, namely the U.S. and Great Britain, resemble each other in face, it is notoriously evident that there are some in America whose souls are perfectly British, and it is believed that there are some in Britain who are American at heart. It is not where a man was born or who he looks like, but what he thinks, which ought at this day to constitute the difference between an American citizen and a British subject. So what is that difference that they're talking about? It seems, just from this quotation, to be quite a profound difference between ways of thinking.
Right. Well, it means whether or not you believe in a republic. And so the author of that particular quotation was saying the essence of being an American is not a nationality. It's not what you look like. It's what you believe. And that a true American is one who believes in the republic, a government where sovereignty derives from the people. And he, the author of that particular newspaper quotation, believed there were people in America who actually were still attracted to the British system. And though they lived in the United States and they looked like other people, he did not consider them to be true Americans. But he also thought there were people living in Britain who longed to have a republic, and so they were at heart Americans.
So the British basically still adhered to the idea of a monarchy. The Americans adhered to the idea of a republic. When you think about how relatively short a time it was between the time when British colonists came to America and the Revolution was fought and won by what became the United States, I mean, how did that profound difference develop?
Well, it's actually quite a wide range of time, in that colonists were coming over from England in the early 1600s, and the Revolution will happen about 150 years after that. So there are many generations of people living in America. But immigrants keep coming in. So what's remarkable about the Revolution is, as you point out, that suddenly people who are very comfortable living under the British system become uncomfortable with it in a period of about 10 years. And, of course, the great initiating issue is parliamentary taxation imposed on the colonies. And this was new. Colonists had paid taxes to their own local assemblies, but they had not paid it to Parliament. And Parliament is insisting upon this as proof that Parliament held sovereignty over the whole empire, including these colonies. And the colonists were then forced to reconsider their political position when Parliament would not budge.
And so you have this thing, we don't want to pay taxes to those guys over there, we don't want to pay taxes to that parliament, they're not representing us. It seems, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems that it's even deeper than that. I mean, the idea of adhering to a monarchy is so different from what we ended up
with. Well, Americans begin with the tax issue, and indeed, initially, the bad guys are the members of parliament, not the king. And the leaders of the colonists kept hoping that the king was going to intervene on their side. So the king had this very positive image. The king wasn't an all-powerful figure. He was much less powerful than Parliament. And so people expected that the king was something of a protector. He was the good cop. And it's only at the very last minute, when they declare independence, that the leaders of the revolution have to suddenly turn on the king and smash him. And so you get Thomas Paine and the famous pamphlet Common Sense, and then also in the Declaration of Independence. Both of those go after the king as a tyrant in a very big way. But that's completely new in 1776. Before that, the king was the good guy, the guy who held the empire together. Parliament was the set of bad guys. But once they make the commitment, the American leaders, that they want to pursue independence, then they have to smash the king and discredit him. And ever since then, we've been misinterpreting the start of the revolution as this revolt against a tyrant king. And nothing could be further from the truth.
So, in theory, if the king had made a different decision, in fact, he could have protected the colonies?
If the king had kind of made it clear to his ministers that he thought it was a bad idea to tax the colonists, those ministers would have backed off, and then Parliament would have backed off.
There is something that you discuss in your work, which is about American identity versus British identity, in the sense that if you're born a British subject, you're British, and Britain tried to enforce that, whereas one could choose to become an American.
Well, this is the concept of American citizenship, that citizenship isn't just by birth, although that's under some threat right now. Historically, the notion of American citizenship is it's something that you choose. And the people in the American Revolution, they were born British subjects, but they chose by revolution to become American citizens. Well, the concept of naturalization extends out from the revolution. It says that immigrants are choosing, they're embracing the American Revolution by migrating here and adopting the American political system and its rights and responsibilities as their own. Now, the British never recognized that process of naturalization. They said if you're born a British subject, you always remain a British subject unless there's an act of Parliament absolving you of that status. So when the Revolution ended and the British made peace with the United States, there was a special act of Parliament which said that the Americans were no longer subjects. But that doesn't apply when an immigrant subsequently leaves Ireland or Scotland or Wales or England and goes to the United States. The United States may make that person a citizen, but in the eyes of the British government, that person remained a British subject.
We're talking to historian Alan Taylor, and his lecture tonight is titled The First American Civil War, The Revolution. So during the American Revolution, did people feel that they were, we think about the Civil War, brothers fighting against brothers, houses divided. Was it the same in the American Revolution?
Absolutely. You have fathers against sons and brothers against brothers. One of the most famous cases is Benjamin Franklin had a son, William Franklin. And William Franklin was a royal governor of New Jersey, and he remained loyal to the empire. But then William Franklin had a son, William Temple Franklin, who rebelled against his father to side with his grandfather in support of the revolution. So you have many families that were split in that sort of way.
And so how did that play out after the revolution, those differences, those family differences?
Well, it plays out in many different ways. Some families reconcile. In some cases, loyalists decide to remain within the United States and make their peace with this new government and this new independence. In other cases, the loyalists leave and they become refugees and they are scattered throughout the British Empire, with the largest concentrations ending up in the maritime provinces of what's now Canada. So you can find the whole range from reconciliation to a bitter enmity that endures.
Another major difference between the U.S. and Great Britain was the idea of imperial government on the one hand versus limited government on the other. Again, what were those differences like in the way that people experienced them? We wanted here in what became the United States, we really wanted limited government.
Well, most people wanted limited government, not everyone. There was an ongoing debate in the New Republic over exactly how much power the federal government should have. The Federalist Party, the party of George Washington and Alexander Hamilton, wanted to build up a pretty strong federal government that could control the state governments. And they interpreted the U.S. Constitution in that light. But they were opposed by the Republican Party of Thomas Jefferson and James Madison. And they wanted a stronger state governments and a weaker central government. So there was an ongoing battle over this issue through the 1790s. And at the end of the 1790s, in the presidential election of 1800 to 1801, Jefferson triumphed, and the Federalists were ousted from power. And so the Jeffersonian Republican side of that debate ended up winning at that time. But this is a debate that we continue to have in this country today.
It is a debate we continue to have in this country today, and the United States has become a power, a world power, on the level that the British Empire used to be, and so we have become, in a funny way, another imperial government. How does that affect how we citizens, or indeed the people governing us, see the original republic and these whole questions of limited versus more extensive government?
Well, it means that you have to kind of pick and choose which founders you want to endorse, and you have to pick and choose from their words. So, for example, people who would like a very limited federal government will pick quotations from Thomas Jefferson. But it's tough to have a consistently limited federal government when you are a superpower. So there are some people who would like to have a very limited federal government for domestic purposes and yet still have this imperial scale superpower, which seems inescapable given America's position in the world right now.
There are also questions about, as you alluded to before, choosing to be an American. That was so much a part of that American identity back a couple of hundred years ago, and now it's something that there's a tremendous pushback against.
Right. Well, there are fearful people in the country who suspect that people who are immigrating now, and particularly if they are perceived to be in violation of immigration laws, that these are people who are hostile to the American way of life, that they will not adapt quickly and successfully. And that just runs in the face of historical evidence over more than two centuries, which is that immigrants are extremely keen to adapt to the American system, the American way of life. And the great majority of them work extremely hard to do so.
So in that original set of arguments between, among the founding fathers, but between the Federalists and those who believed more in Jeffersonian kind of limited government, who are the inheritors of those dynamics today? In other words, we can't really map those quite onto the Democrat and Republican parties anymore, can we?
Those two political parties? No. The Federalist Party was the party of wealth. It was in some ways the more conservative party, but it was also the party of a big federal government at that time. It was a big federal government in terms of they wanted a robust military. So there are some ways in which that describes the contemporary Republican Party, but in some ways not. The Jeffersonians were the party of civil liberties for citizens, but they also tended to be the party that supported the perpetuation of slavery. They were the party of common white men. They were a little bit more of a populist party, you could say. But they were also the party of having a relatively limited federal government and a party that was committed to the dispossession of native peoples at a faster rate. So you'd have to kind of create two different Frankenstein monsters of parts from the two parties to make an equivalent for the two contemporary parties.
The people who were loyalists during the American Revolution, which, as you say, was really, in a lot of ways, the first American Civil War, even though fought on colonial soil. Why were they loyal? What was going on with them?
Well, they were people who were conservative. You could say they believed in law and order. And in many cases, or I would say in almost all cases, they didn't like the taxes that were imposed. But when violence became part of the repertoire of resistance to the taxes, these people felt that violence was going too far. And this was violence mostly against property, destroying tea or smashing people's windows or knocking their fences over. But occasionally it was violence against people, not the killing of people, but the roughing up of people and tarring and feathering people because they were not supporting the tax resistance in all of its forms. So many loyalists said, well, the taxes are bad, but this violent resistance is worse. And we're fearful of a rupture with Britain, that Britain is a superpower of its day. And any kind of armed rebellion against Britain will fail, they felt, and would be a very destructive failure, that American farms would burn and villages would burn and people would lose their property and maybe you would have all of the wreckage of war here in America. So the loyalists are saying these taxes aren't worth that kind of destruction. And let's imagine they would say that the Patriots win. What will we have? We'll have kind of the rule of the mob of violence against people who disagree with the Patriots. We already see that, and we don't want that system to prevail. So the loyalists were people who said, at the end of the day, we prosper as colonists, the taxes aren't that big a deal, and the Patriot performance is actually a greater threat to liberty than are the taxes.
Alan Taylor is professor of American history at the University of California at Davis. He is a Pulitzer Prize winning historian. And once again, the lecture tonight is titled The First American Civil War, The Revolution. It's at the New Mexico History Museum at 6:30, sponsored by the School for Advanced Research, which can be found on the web at sarweb.org. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.